felt that Rice would bring the State Department bureaucracy, including its cadre of Democratic loyalists, more in line with administration policy, whether they agreed with it or not. By contrast, Secretary Powell had deferred more to the career Foreign Service officers. This stance, along with his independent views, caused others in the foreign policy hierarchy to consider him something less than a complete team player. As for me, I think he exemplified what it means to be a team player. He looked out for the interest of the man he served, as well as the country to whom both had sworn allegiance, with great care and wisdom. It was a mistake not to find a way to keep him around. Condi Rice is hard to get to know. She plays her cards close to the vest, usually saving her views for private discussions with Bush. Over time, however, I was struck by how deft she is at protecting her reputation. No matter what went wrong, she was somehow able to keep her hands clean, even when the problems related to matters under her direct purview, including the WMD rationale for war in Iraq, the decision to invade Iraq, the 16 words in the State of the Union address, and post-war planning and implementation of the strategy in Iraq. Some say she should have pushed harder to heed the threat warnings and focus the White House on terrorism prior to 9/11. Although she has been the president's top foreign policy advisor and coordinator of his national security team, she largely allowed responsibility for all these matters to fall on people like former CIA Director George Tenet, Paul Bremer, and Don Rumsfeld. If, as President Bush likes to say, results really do matter, then history will likely judge her harshly as the person responsible for overseeing a number of the defining, and at least in the short term, ill-fated, policies of the Bush administration. But whatever her policy management shortcomings, Rice knew public relations well. She knew how to adapt to potential trouble, dismiss brooding problems, and come out looking like a star. Few perform better under the spotlight, glossing over mistakes with her effortless eloquence and understated flair. And in private, she complimented and reinforced Bush's instincts rather than challenging or questioning them. As far as I could tell from internal meetings and discussions, Condi invariably fell in line with Bush's thinking. If she wasn't actually shaping his thinking, she knew how to read him and how to translate his ideas, feelings, and proclivities into concrete policies. As the new Secretary of State, Rice got off to a strong start. With its public diplomacy component and its strong public relations role, it was a position that seemed well-suited for her dynamic personality, and she surrounded herself with a trusted and tested team that served her interest well. Steve Hadley moved up from his deputy position to become National Security Advisor. Low-key, even-keeled, bright, and tireless in his attention to detail, Hadley played the role of facilitator for the president's thinking and his National Security Council. He worked long hours and understood that he ultimately served the wishes of one person, President Bush. But he also made sure that every principal was fully informed and able to offer his or her full input into matters of policy so that no one was ever excluded or blindsided. Some reports later said that Andy Card had advocated a complete overhaul of the national security team, including the departure of Don Rumsfeld. It sounds credible to me, though this is something Andy would never say in public. His role as an honest broker of the policy process, he felt, demanded such discretion. In any case, the president decided Rumsfeld would stay. Rumsfeld is a strong personality, relentless in pursuing his goals, and utterly convinced that his years of government and corporate experience make him uniquely informed and the only qualified judge of his own decisions. Bush always seemed to show him great deference, sometimes too much. Keeping him in place at the start of the second term meant that defense would continue to be managed the only way Rumsfeld knew, his way. Changes were made in a few other key administration posts. Alberto Gonzalez, who had served as the White House counsel during the first term, was tapped to head the Justice Department. Al was the consummate Bush loyalist, a friend and associate from the Texas days who had doggedly served Bush's personal interest all the way into the White House. He had treated the post of White House counsel very much as that of the president's personal lawyer, working hard to find legal justifications and protections for some of the most controversial policy choices of the administration. These particularly included certain positions championed internally by Cheney and his counsel, David Addington. For example, the decision to broaden authority that would permit the use of once-forbidden interrogation tactics on terror detainees, the administration position that enemy combatants from the war on terror were not entitled to the protections of the Geneva Convention, and the decision to use military tribunals rather than civilian courts to try terror suspects. It's easy to see why Bush, always loyal to trusted longtime friends and averse to change, would want Al in the Attorney General's spot. Harriet Myers, yet another friend from Texas, was named to take Gonzalez's place as White House counsel. But the transition would prove to be more problematic than either man anticipated. It's all right for a White House counsel to be personally dedicated to the president. It's much more questionable when the same is true of an attorney general, whose job is to impartially administer the law of the land, even when the results may be damaging to the president and his party. Because of Al's controversial past positions, his nomination to the job was only narrowly approved on a largely partisan vote. 60 senators, only 6 of them Democrats, voted in favor of the nomination, while 36 were opposed, all Democrats. The close call in the confirmation process foreshadowed what would be a troubled tenure in office. Unable to detach himself from his close association to the president and exert independence, and too closely aligned with the White House's political machinations, Al became caught up in a number of damaging controversies, including one that continues to raise suspicion over whether or not the Justice Department dismissed several U.S. attorneys for partisan reasons. Whipsawed by charges and countercharges, Al ended up resigning in August 2007, and his time as Attorney General has been widely viewed as ineffective. Another cabinet department in need of new leadership as the second term began was Homeland Security, still in its infancy and still struggling to define its identity. A vast, unwieldy agglomeration of dozens of formerly independent agencies, now bundled together under one name and with a new focus, physical threats to the American homeland, that sometimes contradicted the old mandates, Homeland Security was hampered by bureaucratic infighting, incredibly complex coordination challenges, and slumping employee morale. The department needed a leader with great people skills, administrative ability, a powerful overarching vision, and unquestioned integrity. Unfortunately, the first person President Bush selected for the job fell far short of these qualities. Bernard Kerik, a former New York City police commissioner who'd been warmly recommended for the job by Rudolph Giuliani, the former mayor. Giuliani and Kerik had a close personal relationship, not unlike that between Bush and some of his Texas loyalists. In retrospect, it was probably too close. Their friendship may have led Giuliani to overlook a series of ethical missteps that had deeply tainted Kerik's record of public service. Some of Kerik's lapses led to legal problems for him. In 2006, he pleaded guilty to 2 ethics violations and was fined for them, and in 2007, he was indicted on 16 counts of wire fraud, mail fraud, conspiracy, and lying to the IRS. He pleaded not guilty and has not yet been tried on the latter counts. After Bush nominated Kerik for Secretary of Homeland Security in December 2004, revelations about his behavior began flying. This was one episode in which the media illustrated the vital role the press can play in uncovering genuine malfeasance by public officials. Frankly, the media did a better job of vetting Bernard Kerik than the Bush administration did. Kerik was left with no choice but to resign. In January, Bush nominated Michael Chertoff for Homeland Security. A former federal prosecutor, judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals, and Justice Department official, Chertoff was a known quantity to the Bush White House. He had even, along with Viet Dinh, served as co-author of the Patriot Act, a highly touted administration initiative that also became highly controversial. But his qualifications for managing a vast, complex government bureaucracy were questionable, and the liability would come to haunt him during Katrina in ways no one could have anticipated. One of the most meaningful changes made in the 2004 transition was the expansion of Karl Rove's official role within the White House. Rove was named to replace Harriet Myers, the new White House counsel, as Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy. The new title broadened Rove's portfolio by giving him a role in coordinating domestic policy, economic policy, national security in a limited way, not including war policy, and homeland security. A wide-ranging assignment for someone many people, even in Washington, thought of chiefly as a canny political operative. As Peter Baker waggishly put it in the Washington Post, during President Bush's first term, outsiders often suspected that Karl Rove was really behind virtually everything, Now it's official. The move was seen as, in part, a reward for Carl's role as the architect, the man who guided a successful re-election campaign for a president struggling with an increasingly difficult war in Iraq. But it also reconfirmed and strengthened the sense that the Bush administration was deeply committed to maintaining the permanent campaign as a normal operating procedure in Washington. Not only would governing continue to be an offshoot of campaigning, but the master campaigner would now be openly in charge of governing, thus discarding even the pretense of a separation between the two disciplines. Carl was genuinely a policy wonk at heart, but foremost a political mastermind. It was impossible to separate the two. And lurking behind it all remained the magic man, Vice President Cheney. No one knew better how to orchestrate what was happening from behind the curtain while the grand production was playing out on stage. Quietly slipping in and out of internal deliberations, his influence and wand-waving barely discernible to the outside world, Cheney rarely showed all his cards and never disclosed how he made things happen. Yet somehow, in every policy area he cared about, from the invasion of Iraq to expansion of presidential power to the treatment of detainees and the use of surveillance against terror suspects, Cheney always seemed to get his way. He viewed the world as an ominous place where evil has to be fought by any means necessary, including some that are decidedly unpleasant. All in all, the shape and direction of the second term were clear. The administration did not infuse fresh blood and new thinking from outside sources, but eliminated some voices that had represented independent perspectives, such as Secretary Powell's, and elevated people who were known Bush loyalists, practically guaranteed not to challenge the conventional White House thinking, such as Condi Rice and Al Gonzalez. And it reinforced the dominance of the permanent campaign within the administration by giving Karl Rove an even more powerful seat at the table, ensuring that political considerations would never be far from the center of any policy conversation during the second term. Caught up inside the White House bubble, I publicly defended all of Bush's decisions. It was my job. I didn't fully appreciate their implications for the future of the administration, nor did I recognize the serious problems they would help to create during the next 4 years. Re-energized and emboldened by the re-election victory, the Bush administration was ready to begin making the case for yet another aggressive attempt at transformational change. This time, the topic was Social Security, and we wouldn't be satisfied with just any plan for reform. The president had drawn a line in the sand. Personal or private retirement accounts had to be part of the solution. The idea was to create an option for people to invest a small portion, 2 to 4%, of their Social Security dollars into safe stocks, mutual funds, and other appropriate retirement vehicles. It was a perfect Republican initiative. It fit the president's oft-touted theme of the ownership society. It encouraged people to take control of and responsibility for their own future, and it was fiscally responsible to solve a large unfunded liability. It was the kind of bold domestic initiative Bush had always hoped would define his presidency. He would get it passed through a massive campaign to bring public pressure to bear on Congress. A Social Security principals meeting was held in the White House on December 16th to discuss strategy for getting the president's Social Security plan passed in the coming year. The discussion centered on two battles we would have to wage. The first would be to educate the public about the economic and fiscal problems facing Social Security and the need to fix them. The goal of this effort was to create a crisis mentality, which would give us a better shot at getting the necessary public support to bring about bipartisan backing for our reform plan in Congress. The second battle would be to shape the solution and make sure that personal retirement accounts were part of it. Bush's legislative liaison, David Hobbs, understood Congress and what its members respond to. 70% of the battle is defining the problem and putting congressional leaders on the spot. We need public pressure. The plan to create this pressure included extensive travel by the president to the states and districts where targeted members of Congress lived. Bush would use the re-election hopes of these crucial swing voters in Congress as the lever with which to apply the pressure required. We agreed that the principals would meet once a week, our deputies more often. The re-election campaign concluded, the campaign to reshape America's thinking would be back in action, requiring complex, ever-changing choreography among the key players to ensure that a consistent, appealing, powerful message was reaching the people through every channel available to us. But looking back on how we launched this massive campaign effort early in 2005, I wonder whether we were investing our resources wisely. We were spending excessive effort on selling our sketchily designed plan while skimping on other elements of the process that probably should have been at least as important. We weren't spending much time deliberating with members of Congress to work out details of our reform plan. We were doing minimal outreach to Democrats to build the kind of consensus that would make such a dramatic change in the law easier to pass. Instead, we were leapfrogging many of the vital steps and jumping straight to the stage in the process we found most congenial, the public relations effort. It was all vaguely reminiscent of the way we'd short-circuited debate over the necessity for war in Iraq and chose instead to turn it into a subject of a massive marketing blitz. We used a similar approach as we planned the Social Security campaign. With Iraq, it was a threat that needed confronting. With Social Security, it was a crisis that needed solving. And even as our plans were taking shape, we were being dogged by bad news relating to the subject of our last big campaign, the war in Iraq. Throughout the last 2 months of 2004, insurgents and terrorists in Iraq were continuing to wreak havoc. The ongoing violence was a concern, especially with the first scheduled elections just around the corner. By early December, the president decided to increase U.S. troop levels in Iraq to upwards of 150,000 to provide additional security for the elections in January and to keep pressure on the insurgency. Around the same time, on December 7, 2004, the New York Times reported that a classified cable from the CIA Baghdad chief was warning of a deteriorating situation in Iraq that was unlikely to rebound anytime soon. According to the paper, another CIA official who had visited Iraq a short time earlier had offered a similar assessment. The article also noted that Bush had dismissed an earlier national intelligence estimate, including a dark forecast for Iraq's future through the end of 2005, calling it simply one possibility among many. It was an early indication that the re-election victory was not going to alter the administration's attitude toward bad news. A president who has been handed an electoral mandate and faces no more future election contest might very well take advantage of those circumstances and to reach out to seek a consensus approach for improving a policy whose results were less than satisfactory. But Bush and his team chose not to do so. On Wednesday, December 8th, with the high levels of violence in Iraq continuing and the security situation deteriorating, Secretary Rumsfeld met with soldiers about to be deployed to Iraq at their staging base in Kuwait. He was asked pointed questions about poor equipment and extended deployments. Tennessee National Guard Army Specialist Thomas Wilson asked about the lack of sufficient numbers of armored combat vehicles. Why do we soldiers have to dig through local landfills for pieces of scrap metal and compromised ballistic glass to up-armor our vehicles? Asked Wilson. Rumsfeld's response would prove to be a defining moment of his career, and not a positive one. As you know, you go to war with the army you have, replied the defense secretary. They're not the army you might want or wish to have at a later time. If you think about it, you can have all the armor in the world on a tank, and a tank can be blown up, he later added. Democratic leaders in Congress jumped on Rumsfeld's comments, calling them stunning and callous. When asked about them at the next morning's gaggle, I defended Rumsfeld personally, but I knew better than to try to defend his comments. Secretary Rumsfeld has a practice of speaking directly with our troops in harm's way, I said. You saw that yesterday. The secretary is someone who cares deeply about our men and women in uniform, and he is committed to doing all he can to address their concerns. But his comments helped solidify an already accepted media narrative. The administration was sending troops that were ill-equipped to fight the IED threat from terrorists and insurgents. Worse still, administration officials were either unaware of the problems, unable to fix them, or totally unconcerned. Even well-intentioned gestures designed to create positive impressions of the war effort seemed to backfire during this period. On December 14th, the president awarded the Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civil award, given to men and women of exceptional merit, integrity, and achievement, to three leaders he described as men who have played pivotal roles in great events and whose efforts have made our country more secure and advanced the cause of human liberty. The three were key players in his Iraq policy: former CIA Director George Tenet, former head of Central Command, retired General Tommy Franks, and former head of the Coalition Provisional Authority in Iraq, Paul Bremer. Against a backdrop of discouraging news from Iraq, as well as a mounting chorus of criticism specifically aimed at all three men, particularly Tenet, who had reportedly described the flawed Iraq WMD intelligence as a slam dunk, and Bremer, who had made several major miscalculations during the early months of the occupation, the ceremony drew plenty of criticism. Wasn't this supposed to be an administration that prided itself on results and believed in responsibility and accountability? If so, why the rush to hand out medals to people who had helped organize what was now looking like a badly botched, ill-conceived war? The growing backlash against the war threatened to engulf the president himself. At Bush's end-of-year news conference on December 20th, he was pressed to defend his Secretary of Defense. He did so in a personal way. "I know Secretary Rumsfeld's heart. I know how much he cares for the troops. He and his wife go out to Walter Reed in Bethesda all the time to provide comfort and solace. I have seen the anguish in his, or heard the anguish in his voice, and seen his eyes when we talk about the danger in Iraq, and the fact that youngsters are over there in harm's way. And he's a good, decent man. He's a caring fellow. Sometimes perhaps his demeanor is rough and gruff, but beneath that rough and gruff, no-nonsense demeanor is a good human being who cares deeply about the military and deeply about the grief that war causes." It was a typical assessment by Bush, who often speaks about the people he likes in terms of their inner character, a good man, a decent man, rather than in terms of their concrete behaviors and actions. Bush didn't try to defend Rumsfeld's badly chosen words in Kuwait or his errors in judgment over the management of the war. Instead, he simply assessed the hidden qualities of the man as if these outweighed his actions and erased their negative consequences. One might call this a redemptive Christian perspective in which forgiveness is seen as washing away every misdeed. But it didn't jibe with the self-image of an administration supposedly focused on accountability and results, nor did it satisfy the growing unhappiness of Americans who were wondering whether their children and their treasure were being squandered to no good purpose. In the same conference, following a strategy we discussed behind the scenes, the president also tried to give what would be referred to in the media as a candid and sober assessment of the situation in Iraq. He spoke about the suicide bombings and IEDs, and he acknowledged that difficulties remained. He also left the impression that our troops would need to remain in Iraq for a while, without saying specifically how long. The next day's Washington Post poll showed that 56% of Americans now believed the war was a mistake and not worth fighting. A majority also said Rumsfeld should resign. The administration had tried positive spin, denial, and now, belatedly, candor and realism, but to no avail. The stark news on the ground was conveying its own message, and it was one the American people found increasingly troubling. But those of us inside the White House, as we headed into the new year, missed the multiplying warning signs. The president's approval rating was shaky, hovering just above the majority mark, the lowest it had been prior to any previous State of the Union address. Clearly, the president received no post-election bounce. The goodwill evident 4 years earlier, as he began his presidency, was nowhere to be found, and Bush was doing little to build any. He seemed determined to play the game Washington's way, not appreciating how much his policies and actions had contributed to poisoning the atmosphere. The narrow election victory supplied no real mandate. There was only division and polarization, and none of us in the president's inner circle seemed to realize how problematic it was at the time. Instead, we clung to the notion of a mandate, refusing to accept it for what it was, an illusion. And all the while, the situation in Iraq continued to worsen. As far as the president and his foreign policy team were concerned, the strategy was in place and the resources were in position to confront the approaching storm. Our troops would continue to aggressively pursue the insurgents and terrorists. Our diplomats would continue to push the political process forward. The January elections were a foremost priority, a potential turning point that might give hope to Iraqis and dampen the will and spirit of the insurgency. After a provisional government had been elected, the focus could shift to smaller reconstruction projects that could provide concrete help and hope to citizens across the country. Meanwhile, we would push ahead on training Iraqi forces so they could assume increasing responsibility for the country's security. In the formula we often used, as they stood up, American forces could stand down. It was a logical-sounding program for long-term success in Iraq. The problem was that it didn't match up with reality. There were serious problems still not being identified and addressed. U.S. force levels inside Iraq were insufficient and were being stretched to the limit through repeated redeployments. The troops would continue carrying an immense burden and doing it well, but ending the violence and securing the expansive country was a major challenge and problem given the force level. Reconstruction was increasingly hampered by the deteriorating security situation. Projects were slowed by the frequent attacks, thereby denying Iraqis essential services. The length of time it was taken to equip and train Iraqi forces to assume security responsibilities independent of American help was too long. And underlying it all was growing sectarian division rooted in history and fomented by insurgents, unsanctioned militias, and terrorists. American troops were doing their job well, but they could only do so much. They needed more from Washington, but it was growing more polarized as the conflict dragged on. Bush's way of managing the problems in Iraq was proving inadequate to the task. He received regular updates and held frequent meetings as he sought to improve the situation through personal persuasion and pressure on Iraqi leaders. But he was insulated from the reality of events on the ground and consequently began falling into the trap of believing his own spin. He failed to spend enough time seeking independent input from a broad range of outside experts, those beyond the White House bubble who had firsthand experience on the ground in Iraq, and perhaps most important, those with differing points of view, including those who disagreed with his policies. The failure to open up the Bush White House to fresh perspectives in the second term was already beginning to exact a price. Chapter 14. Revelation and Humiliation. By mid-2004, Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald had been pushing ahead to wrap up the leak investigation. Speculation was swirling that Fitzgerald was either seeking an indictment or two, or was just trying to wrap up a complicated, messy investigation. But he needed the help of two reporters to complete his investigation, and had sought their grand jury testimony for the better part of a year. One was Matthew Cooper, a quick-witted, soft-spoken Time magazine White House correspondent. The other was New York Times Washington reporter Judith Miller, who had written extensively about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction, based on intelligence from the U.S. government and foreign governments during the lead-up to the invasion. Cooper and Miller refused to tell Fitzgerald what they knew about the leak case. They were holding steadfast to the journalistic credo not to divulge confidential, anonymous sources to anyone, and especially not in a way that might cause them to become known publicly. For Cooper and Miller, this was a fundamental freedom of the press issue. Reporters often depend on anonymous sources to get information that helps hold government officials accountable. If contempt of court rulings were used to force disclosure of such sources, it could inhibit people from talking to reporters at all, making investigative journalism far more difficult in the future. Of course, there was a curious twist to the defense used by Cooper and Miller in this case. By refusing to divulge the names of their sources in the leak case, the two reporters were not protecting courageous whistleblowers revealing government wrongdoing in the public interest. Rather, they were shielding government officials who administration critics believed had used leaks as weapons of partisan warfare. It was hard for some in the public, and especially those critical of the administration, to see this as an act of journalistic courage. In the days of Watergate, crusading newspaper reporters battling for the truth were depicted on movie screens by actors like Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman. This episode, however, seemed to confirm for at least some administration critics that reporters were no longer heroic figures, but were now participating in the same partisan warfare they covered. Fitzgerald, who had subpoenaed both reporters early in the investigation, dismissed the freedom of the press defense and said their testimony was crucial to his ability to wrap up his investigation and make a determination whether or not a crime had been committed. He had obtained signed waivers from administration officials that absolved reporters of any previous confidentiality agreements, and he sought a court order compelling their testimony. If Cooper and Miller refused, he said the court should hold them in contempt and send them to jail until they were willing to talk. For Cooper and Miller, the waivers changed nothing. since their sources could have felt forced to sign them in the face of a criminal investigation. This was not, in their view, a voluntary, uncoerced assurance. For Fitzgerald, it was a matter of finding out the truth about possible criminal wrongdoing and what the appeals court would uphold as the government's critical need for their testimony. The issue generated intense media attention as Cooper and Miller dug in their heels. A feeding frenzy ensued outside the federal courthouse building whenever the two reporters appeared. In August 2004, Judge Thomas F. Hogan of the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia found both Cooper and Time magazine in contempt of court. Miller suffered a similar blow the following October. Both were fined and ordered to serve jail time. The judge, with Fitzgerald's agreement, stayed the orders until their appeals were exhausted. Miller would ultimately be sentenced to prison for contempt of court. Starting on July 6, 2005, she would spend 85 days of a four-month sentence in jail before finally receiving uncoerced personal assurance from the source she was protecting. It was Scooter Libby, who had told her, according to Miller's later testimony, that Wilson's wife worked at the CIA, though she had never reported the fact. Cooper, after a last-minute voluntary release from confidentiality from his source, Carl Rove, avoided jail time. By July 2005, reports had begun circulating that Rove had spoken with Matt Cooper for the story he'd written about Joe Wilson's mission to Niger. On July 4, 2005, Michael Isikoff, a respected investigative journalist for Newsweek, broke the story that Carl was one of Cooper's sources. He received confirmation from Robert Luskin, Carl's personal attorney. However, Luskin told Isikoff that Carl had neither knowingly disclosed classified information nor told any reporter that Valerie Plame worked for the CIA. Isikoff noted that exactly what passed between Cooper and Rove was unclear. And on Sunday, July 10, 2005, halfway into the first year of the president's second term and nearly 2 years after Robert Novak's column revealing the identity of Valerie Plame, another critical piece of information that Cooper had previously refused to divulge became public for the first time. I'd heard through the grapevine that Isikoff had another scoop for Newsweek, with specifics about what Carl told Cooper. I remember speculating that more than likely, Cooper had asked him about Wilson's wife, but as Carl had indicated to Claire and me about his call with Novak, he could not confirm anything because he did not know. And the president had told me that he, too, had been personally assured that Carl did not leak the information. Maybe I did not want to believe that Carl had not been completely forthcoming, or that what he had told me and the president was not true. Later that morning, Harriet Myers, a longtime Bush loyalist from Texas who had taken over as White House counsel when Al Gonzalez was confirmed as Attorney General, called me through the White House operator. Like me, Harriet had served in the Bush White House since day one. The West Wing was quiet that day. I'd come in to catch up on work, watch some of the Sunday political shows that were taped, and prepare for the week ahead, free from interruptions. Harriet was calling from her office and said she needed to come and talk to me about something important. She walked in, closed the door behind her, and said, "There's some news that's likely to come out tomorrow about Carl and the leak investigation that may appear to contradict what you said nearly 2 years ago." "I heard," I said, thinking about Isikoff's report, but not taking time to let what she had just said fully sink in. Harriet reiterated to me that we still could not comment on the investigation publicly. In effect, she was forbidding me from talking and setting the record straight about my previous comments. Then, just before she headed out of my office, Harriet said, "You know, Scott, I always feel bad because I feel like I only make your job tougher." "That's okay. It's my job," I said almost reflexively, so as to lessen any angst for a person I really liked. After she left, I wondered about what the article would say and how it would contradict what I had said. Later that day, I learned the truth. Isikoff's article revealed that Carl had spoken with Cooper specifically about Wilson's wife working at the CIA. According to Isikoff, Cooper had written in an email to his boss, Time Washington Bureau Chief Michael Duffy, that Carl had warned him not to get too far out on Wilson. Cooper's email went on to note that Carl said Wilson's trip was not authorized by CIA Director George Tenet. "It was," KR said, "Wilson's wife, who apparently works at the agency on WMD issues, who authorized the trip." Cooper continued, Not only the genesis of the trip is flawed and suspect, but so is the report. He, Rove, implied strongly there's still plenty to implicate Iraqi interest in acquiring uranium from Niger. Cooper stated up front in the email that it was confidential and that Rove had only spoken to him on double super secret background for about 2 minutes before he went on vacation, according to Isikoff. The date of the email was Friday morning, July 11, 2003, 3 days before Novak's column revealing Plame's identity was published. It related to the story Time was working on about Wilson, his trip to Niger, and the White House efforts to discredit him. A War on Wilson, published on July 17, 2003. In his Newsweek article, Isikoff placed his latest bombshell in context. Rove's words on the Plame case have always been carefully chosen. "I didn't know her name, I didn't leak her name," Rove told CNN last year when asked if he had anything to do with the Plame leak. Rove has never publicly acknowledged talking to any reporter about former Ambassador Joseph Wilson and his wife. But last week, his lawyer, Robert Luskin, confirmed to Newsweek that Rove did, and that Rove was the secret source who, at the request of both Cooper's lawyer and the prosecutor, gave Cooper permission to testify. "Nothing in the Cooper email suggests that Rove used Plame's name or knew she was a covert operative," Isikoff wrote. "Nonetheless, it is significant that Rove was speaking to Cooper before Novak's column appeared. In other words, before Plame's identity had been published. Fitzgerald has been looking for evidence that Rove spoke to other reporters as well." According to Isikoff, a source close to Rove said that a fair reading of the email makes clear that the information conveyed was not part of an organized effort to disclose Plame's identity, but was an effort to discourage Time from publishing things that turned out to be false. The most likely source was Luskin, Carl's attorney, since he was quoted in other parts of the article. Reportedly, the source was concerned about being quoted on the record discussing publicly what Carl had testified to privately before the grand jury as part of an investigation that was still underway. "Clearly, I had allowed myself to be deceived. In the coming weeks and months, I would discover that the deceit went well beyond Rove." These revelations would soon have a painful, chilling effect on my relationships with reporters. On CNN's late edition for Sunday, July 17, 2005, John King, the guest host who had been CNN's chief White House correspondent for years, summed up the attitude of his colleagues in the briefing room. "They were willing to vouch for me to a point because they had come to know me and my reputation, but they could not go too far without a public explanation of events from me." The reporter's attitude would prove hurtful, but understandable. It wasn't so much an indictment of me as of the administration I worked for. The implication was clear. If some of the highest-ranking officials of the Bush White House hadn't been forthright with the president's chief spokesman, how could anyone assume they were honest with the public? The White House had a serious credibility problem, and I was now going to take the heat for it. The impact of that Sunday conversation and the imminent Newsweek scoop was the equivalent of getting whacked upside the head with a 2x4. I never saw it coming, given Carl's personal assurances to me and the president, at least not until the final few days before it became public. And even then, I convinced myself not to believe the growing buzz in Washington because of the personal assurances I had received. The Monday briefing following Isikoff's jolting revelation was brutal. After the initial period of the leak episode, nearly 2 years earlier, I had used the line, "I'm not going to comment on an ongoing investigation." It would end the questioning quickly, but not this day, given what I had so confidently asserted at the outset in the fall of 2003. John Roberts of CBS made sure to point out that I had, in fact, commented while the investigation had been underway for nearly 2 weeks, and he wondered why the change. Roberts was right, and I knew it. Although I had cleared Rove initially before notice of any investigation, I had not cleared Libby at the vice president's request and the president's direction until after we were informed about it. NBC's David Gregory mockingly said it was ridiculous that I would not answer whether I stood by my previous assertions of no involvement by Rove, Libby, and Abrams, chiding me for unresponsively not saying anything about the Newsweek revelations. Then Terry Moran of ABC swung the pinata stick, saying I was in a tough spot, before derisively asking, "All of a sudden, you have respect for the sanctity of the criminal investigation?" Eventually, long after leaving the White House, I came to see that standing in front of the speeding press bus in those days had much more to do with protecting the president and White House from further political embarrassment than respecting the sanctity of the investigation. We would get to other topics that day, but reporters kept coming back to issue number one. The newscasts that evening were about as negative and biting as they could be. I could feel something fall out of me into the abyss as each reporter took a turn whacking me. It was my reputation crumbling away, bit by bit, and my affection for the job eventually followed it. I kept going through the motions, much as I had when my older brothers occasionally pounded me when we fought as kids, at least before I caught up with them in size and strength. I was unable to do a thing about it other than put on a brave face and refuse to let them know they had gotten the best of me. The briefing could not end soon enough. The ridicule I received that day and the following ones, though dispiriting and humiliating, was justified, given what I had previously said. Since my hands were tied, about all I could do was go into a defensive crouch and stonewall. The post-briefing critique with my deputies was somber. They knew I'd been put in an impossible spot. "It is what it is," said one deputy, Trent Duffy, a constant source of candid advice. "Nothing you can do about it. You're in a tough spot." The other two, Dana Perino and NSC spokesman Fred Jones, expressed their sincere empathy for me personally. Back in my office later that afternoon, I received a phone call from Carl Rove. "I just want to say I'm sorry for what you're going through." Given the continuing investigation, I knew that was as full an apology as he would offer. It's clear to me Carl was only concerned about protecting himself from possible legal action and preventing his many critics from bringing him down. The network news coverage by White House correspondents that night was understandably unforgiving, harsh on the White House and on my credibility, which didn't help the president's either. Each played clips of my statements in the fall of 2003 and reported how they were now being contradicted. John Roberts summed it up. "It was a bad day at the White House. Unable to defend its own on-the-record statements, unable to explain why it repeatedly said with such certainty 21 months ago, now would appear so demonstrably false." Robert's colleague, Bill Plant, concluded his report the following morning by saying, "There are other people involved in this controversy over the outing of the CIA officer, but if Rove is truly not a target of the investigation, the White House at worst still looks stupid." That same morning, Carl ran the senior staff meeting in Andy's absence. Usually, I was the second one to speak, following a quick rundown of the president's public schedule for the day. Before Carl turned it over to me, he said for all our senior staff colleagues to hear that he was really sorry for what I was going through. Carl paused momentarily, looking at me intently, almost waiting for me to say, "Don't worry about it, no big deal." But all I could do was grimace expressionlessly, nod my head slightly, and acknowledge his remorse by softly uttering, "Thank you. Appreciate it." The next day, I found a handwritten apology from Carl waiting on the chair in my office. Later that week, it would become known, confirmed anonymously by Carl's attorney, Robert Luskin, that Carl had been the second source for Novak's original column disclosing Plame's identity. Dick Stevenson, a White House correspondent, and his New York Times colleague, David Johnston, got the scoop for that Friday's story. It was part of Carl's and Luskin's strategy. Carl's attorney insisted to reporters that he had not leaked or disclosed Plame's identity. Novak, according to Luskin, had said he'd heard Wilson's wife worked at the CIA, and Carl had responded, "I heard that too." And the Times article said the anonymous source, Luskin, discussed the matter in the belief that Mr. Rove was truthful in saying that he had not disclosed Miss Wilson's identity. The Times story said that Novak had described the two senior administration officials in a follow-on column published October 1, 2003. His primary source, who was yet to be revealed, was no partisan gunslinger, according to Novak, and the second official, Rove, had only confirmed that, "Oh, you know about it." At a press conference the following Monday, held with visiting Prime Minister Singh of India, the AP's Terry Hunt asked the president about Carl and the leak investigation. "Mr. President," Hunt said, "you said you don't want to talk about an ongoing investigation, so I'd like to ask you, regardless of whether a crime was committed, do you still intend to fire anyone found to be involved in the CIA leak case? And are you displeased that Carl Rove told a reporter that Ambassador Joe Wilson's wife worked for the agency on WMD issues?" We have a serious ongoing investigation here, the president said. He then continued, and it's being played out in the press, and I think it's best that people wait until the investigation is complete before you jump to conclusions, and I will do so as well. I don't know all the facts. I want to know all the facts. The best place for the facts to be done is by somebody who's spending time investigating it. I would like this to end as quickly as possible so we know the facts, and if someone committed a crime, they will no longer work in my administration. The last line was part of a strategy for the president to clarify the terms of firing. Dan Bartlett thought the president needed to have something to say to that very question we knew would come up, and that it was best to go ahead and redefine the terms of firing someone who might have been involved in the leak, specifically Carl. Feeling psychologically battered, I quietly went along with Dan's construct, barely objecting that it did not square with what the president had previously committed to do. The media played it up as a changed position, as we knew they would, but it was best to go ahead and do it sooner than later. I was disappointed to see the president backpedal, but I understood his motivation. The whole situation surrounding Carl, who still maintained he had never knowingly or intentionally leaked Plame's classified identity, was murky, at least as the president would have seen it, and Carl was a very important part of the president's team. One day around that time, I don't even remember how it came up, I recall Andy saying to me in private something about how staffers felt bad for me because I'd been left hanging out to dry, unable to defend myself, whereas other staffers felt the White House should vigorously defend Carl. I think Andy felt bad for the spot I had been put in, partly as a result of his call to me that first Saturday morning in October 2003. But the Rove revelations were not the last time my words and credibility would be undermined. 3 months later, the Vice President's Chief of Staff, Scooter Libby, who might have been specifically directed to exonerate, would be indicted by Special Counsel Patrick Fitzgerald for one count of obstruction of justice, 2 counts of making false statements to FBI agents, and 2 counts of perjury before the grand jury. It would be revealed at the time that in addition to Miller, he had spoken to Cooper, though not Novak, about Plame, contrary to my public assertions that he had assured me otherwise. It was also revealed that he had shared the classified information with my predecessor, Ari Fleischer, in an apparently successful effort to use him to leak the information to reporters. Fleischer later testified that he did not know the information was classified. Over the coming weeks and months, Carl was vigorously defended by the Republican National Committee, whose hand-picked chairman, Ken Mellman, had previously been Carl's top White House aide and my former colleague. Conservative pundits and opinion leaders joined in the defense, orchestrated in part through Carl's attorney, Mellman and Mark Carollo, the veteran spokesman Carl had personally hired to deal with the investigation. In the end, after several lengthy grand jury appearances, Carl escaped indictment. Reports indicated he had not revealed his discussion with Matt Cooper about Plame initially to the grand jury. Then, after his attorney Robert Luskin learned about it in casual conversation from another Time reporter, Rove reportedly threw himself on the mercy of the jury. Ken Mellman strongly defended my honor and integrity in talk show appearances, as Dan Bartlett did on CNN. But my most credible defenders were the same well-known White House correspondents who had pounded me that week of the Rove revelation and later the week of the Libby indictment. And they were credible because they were not spinning or obfuscating for partisan purposes, but simply expressing what they knew to be true. For example, during an appearance on Hardball with Chris Matthews on October 31, 2005, David Gregory, the chief White House correspondent for NBC News, and my toughest, least courteous nemesis in the briefing room, was asked about my position. It was the Monday following Fitzgerald's single indictment in the investigation, with Fitzgerald continuing to investigate Carl's role as I continued my defensive no-comment posture at the podium about the whole affair. It gets kind of hot in that briefing room, doesn't it, these days? Matthews asked Gregory. It can, and it does, certainly when it has to do with Scott McClellan's statements about these individuals not being involved in any way, shape, or form, Gregory said. Then he added, I mean, Scott is in a tough position. We understand that because he's being told, as are all White House employees, by the White House counsel, Harriet Myers, by the way, not to talk about any of this. But the reality is that he made a public statement about getting assurances directly from Carl Rove and Scooter Libby that they were not involved with any of this, and that was not the case. Because even if it is not a crime, and we know that Scooter Libby has been accused of committing a crime of obstruction of justice and perjury, Karl Rove has not been accused of any crime. They were indeed involved in conversations about a covert officer of the CIA. And you don't have to believe me, that's what Special Prosecutor Fitzgerald said of Plame's classification. So that's the spot that he's in. And it's a question of credibility. And Scott said to us, look, you the members of the press corps know me. I'm a credible guy. That's true. He has a sterling reputation. But it's a question for the American people, you know. It's a real question if you say something that turns out not to be true. The previous day on CNN's Reliable Sources with Washington Post media reporter Howard Kurtz, CBS's John Roberts had come to my defense. John Roberts, do you believe that Scott McClellan owes the press and the public an apology for his, what turned out to be misleading denial in the CIA leak case? Kurtz asked. Well, you know, Howie, I may be one of the people in the minority, but I think that he's getting a really rough deal on this, Roberts said. You know, he doesn't go out and freelance this stuff. He goes out there and he tries to faithfully articulate whatever it is that the White House tells him. Obviously, in October of 2003, he got some pretty bad information. Is it his fault that he conveyed that information? I don't think so. I think the people who are at fault are, the ones at fault are the ones who gave him what now appears to be bad information. So I think that Scott, you know, I've known him for a number of years now. I've got a pretty good working relationship with him. I think that he is a truth teller. I think he is a stand-up guy. And I just think he was just told to carry somebody else's water, and it just turned out that that water was foul. On the same day, in a roundtable appearance on This Week with George Stephanopoulos, Terry Moran, ABC's chief White House correspondent, also defended my reputation with his candor. What does the White House do now about their press secretary, Scott McClellan, and the fact on occasion after occasion after occasion, he had absolute blanket denials? There was no involvement by Rove, no involvement by Libby, Stephanopoulos asked. It's an incredibly difficult position to put the press secretary in, Moran responded. I was in the room. He was telling falsehoods right at us over and over unwittingly. But do you think he knew? Panelist Cokie Roberts inquired. No, said Moran, and he signaled that he wants to tell us the story, he added, referring to my sincere comments at the podium that I would like nothing more than to be able to talk about events surrounding my public exoneration of Rove and Libby. I got to press this then, Stephanopoulos said. Okay, you say he didn't know it, so that means that Karl Rove lied to him. Yes, Moran said, yes. What does the president do about that? Stephanopoulos asked. He's got to do something, Moran said, before correctly predicting the continued awful communication strategy of stonewalling. My sense is, right now, they'll kick this down the road. They'll say it's a continuing criminal case, and we're going to kick it down the road. We had a presidency just recently where the president lied to his press secretary and everybody else in the White House, Roberts added in reference to Bill Clinton. But what does the president do? Stephanopoulos pressed. George Will jumped in. At this point, change the subject, he said. It's an old axiom in politics. If you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own, as he correctly suggested the president would do by naming a new Supreme Court nominee following Harriet Meyer's withdrawal just days earlier. The president nominated Sam Alito to the bench the very next morning, but that did nothing to alleviate my painful humiliation or ward off the continued blows to the credibility of the Bush administration. In an interview with Republican Party Chairman Melman, John King of CNN said, "You call Scott McClellan a good man. I agree with you. A little dangerous for me. I'm supposed to be objective here. He is a good guy. He has one of the toughest jobs in Washington. I've been in that briefing room during questions like this in this administration, questions like this in the Clinton administration. He has, if you watch, fairly or unfairly, suffered some damage in that room. His credibility is at question with the people who cover the president every day because of this." King then asked Melman, "So you're essentially saying that it is a fair price, Scott McClellan, a man who has been loyal to this president back to his days as governor of Texas, his credibility is a fair price to defend Karl Rove?" What I'm saying is that Scott McClellan and Karl Rove and George W. Bush are less worried about personal credibility than they are about a process, Melman said. They want to get to the bottom of this. They want to make sure that justice gets done. And the way justice gets done is not to have the White House and president making comments from the podium about an investigation of the White House. And so I think what he is doing is, frankly, very admirable. And I think the fact that he's willing to put himself second and put the process first is exactly what we talk about when we say somebody is coming to Washington to serve rather than worry about themselves. Clinging to the candid words from my briefing room inquisitors, I deceived myself further by thinking my reputation and credibility with the press could survive in the absence of an honest personal explanation, which I was prevented from making because I went along with directions not to comment. In hindsight, the strong relationship of trust that I had established with the White House press corps could do little except permit a badly wounded spokesman and his damaged credibility to survive the next several months. And just barely. There's only one moment during the leak episode that I'm reluctant to discuss. However, since I'm committed to telling the truth as I know it, and since the moment seems to be of some relevance given its timing and nature, I feel that full disclosure is the only option. It was in 2005, during a time when attention was focusing on Rove and Libby, and it sticks vividly in my mind. I don't recollect the exact day, but it was following a staff meeting in Andy Card's office. He shared a two-office suite. Three staff assistants worked in a common area that connected the two offices and served as a waiting area and entrance to both. The second office was for the Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy, who at the time was Karl Rove. The meeting in Andy's office included some principals, or assistants to the president, and some deputies, or deputy assistants to the president. I believe some special assistants were also in attendance. Following the meeting, some of us, maybe a handful, were still working our way out the door of the suite's common area and mingling at its entryway, near the door to Carl's office and in front of his able assistant, Taylor Hughes's desk. Scooter Libby was walking to the entryway as he prepared to depart when Carl turned to get his attention. "You have time to visit?" Carl asked. "Yeah," replied Libby. They were just a few feet from me before they disappeared behind the closing door to Carl's office. I have no idea what they discussed, but it seemed suspicious for these two, whom I had never noticed spending any one-on-one time together, to go behind closed doors and visit privately. Carl's office door was always open unless there was a real need for privacy. It was not unusual for me to stick my head in his door and briefly interrupt. Carl always tended to be busy working on countless issues, events, or plans. If I needed to get information from him to prepare for the press briefing, information I always had to obtain under time constraints, the easiest way was to just go to him. Why would I remember this moment so vividly? Because these are the two colleagues, one a fellow Texan, I put my credibility on the line to defend, the two who assured me unequivocally they were not involved in leaking the identity of Valerie Plame. At least one of them, Rove, it was publicly known by that time, had at best misled me by not sharing relevant information. Incredible rumors were spreading that the other, Libby, had done at least as much. The confidential meeting also occurred at a moment when I was being battered by the press for publicly vouching for the two by claiming they were not involved in leaking Plame's identity, when recently revealed information was now indicating otherwise. In the 4 years we had all worked together at the White House, I had never seen the two meet one-on-one. Now, here they were, meeting privately behind closed doors late in the game, when both were under investigation and intensifying public scrutiny. I do not know what was discussed, but what would any knowledgeable person reasonably and logically conclude was the topic? Like the whole truth of people's involvement, we will likely never know with any degree of confidence. A growing sense of burnout led me to briefly consider resigning, but I never felt the president himself had knowingly misled me or withheld relevant information from me. And despite some uncertainties from within about the course we were on, I remained determined to honor my commitment to him without appreciating how difficult it would be. I imagine some believe my resignation at that moment could have helped the president. Maybe so. But it was Bush's unconscious acquiescence and at times, enabling of deception that put us in such a precarious position. It would continue plaguing his presidency and his standing with the public, instead of embracing openness and forthrightness to prevent the scandal from taking hold. He allowed suspicion to grow and partisan warfare to flourish. More than 30 years later, Nixon's legacy of the permanent scandal culture was bedeviling yet another president who'd failed to learn the lessons of Watergate. I certainly paid a price as a result, but a far greater price was paid by the Bush administration and by the nation it was pledged to serve. Chapter 15. Out of Touch. The conference call began around 5 a.m. on Tuesday, August 30th, 2005. I'd been up a while, unable to sleep. We'd arrived in California the day before from Texas, where the president, as usual, was spending much of August working out of his home in Crawford. Along with many others on the staff, he was still operating on Central Standard Time. The president had come to San Diego to make some remarks commemorating the 60th anniversary of VJ Day in a speech to veterans, Marines, Special Operations Forces, Navy officers, sailors, and aviators at Naval Air Station North Island. Secretary Rumsfeld, traveling separately, was there as well. After that, Bush was scheduled to visit some wounded Navy SEALs and Marines at the nearby medical facility before returning to Crawford for the last few days of the summer. One of the fringe benefits of being on the president's traveling staff, or road crew, as we often referred to ourselves, was staying with him in luxury hotels. On this trip, my room in the historic Hotel del Coronado, a five-star resort on San Diego's Coronado Island, locally known as the Del, was just a few rooms down the hall from the president's. The trip west had been planned long in advance. No one could have anticipated that this would be the weekend when a catastrophic hurricane would hit the United States. The sheer size of Hurricane Katrina's reach and destructive power, covering more than 90,000 square miles, was difficult to imagine. The purpose of this morning's conference call was to update some of the president's key team members on the current situation in the aftermath of the storm and, most important, make a determination about Bush's immediate plans. We'd known for a while that the hurricane would be a bad one. President Bush had taken the unusual step of declaring both Louisiana and Mississippi disaster areas on the previous Saturday and Sunday, respectively, before the hurricane hit. He'd made these declarations at the request of Governors Kathleen Blanco and Haley Barbour, with whom the administration had been in contact, in part so that the cost of the emergency preparations being made by the states could be reimbursed after the fact by the federal government. A series of increasingly drastic preparatory steps had been taken, including, on Sunday morning, the first mandatory evacuation order in the history of New Orleans, issued by Mayor Ray